We live in a world that appears to be governed by cause and effect. In other words, something occurs and a subsequent effect is experienced. For example, someone flipped the light switch and the lights came on. It's a really deep message tonight, isn't it? The dodo bird was overhunted by Dutch sailors, and within 100 years it went extinct. Or someone who never brushes their teeth will end up with no teeth. There are endless examples of cause and effect in this world in which we live. But the cause happened prior to the effect. Even the strength of the cause can determine the measure of the effect. If I walked halfway across the town bridge and dropped over the side one barrel of oil, that would damage some wildlife. If an oil tanker came up the town and ran aground and all the oil came out, that would probably kill everything, if there is anything, in the town. The measure can be determined by the strength of the cause. And you can apply that same logic, cause and effect logic, within a theological framework. You think, for example, of Genesis 3 and the effect of Adam and Eve's rebellion, the effect that has had on us. Romans 5, verse 12, sin entered the world through one man, and death through sin. And in this way, death came to all men because all sinned. Sin was the cause. Universal death was the catastrophic effect. Even here in our study of 2 Samuel, we've already seen the effect on himself and on others of Saul having rejected and disobeyed the Lord. Back in 1 Samuel 28, 18, it says, because you, Saul, did not obey the Lord or carry out his fierce wrath against the Amalekites, the Lord has done this to you today. Cause and effect. And so Saul and his sons die in battle on Mount Gilboa. What follows here in this narrative is the effect or the serious repercussions on others caused by bad motives. For example, the repercussions on the soldiers, in fact, the whole of Israel, because of Abner's continual opposition towards God. Or what about the serious repercussion on himself of Asahel's self-confidence, his miscalculated self-confidence in pursuing Abner? We can look at these examples here this evening of cause and effect, bad motives and serious repercussions. And hopefully we can learn from them together tonight for how we ought to watch out for, how we ought to be careful, how we ought to live and behave as God's people in this generation. So the first section I want us to look at this evening is the poolside bloodbath. In verses 12 to 17, the poolside bloodbath. It's by this pool of Gibeon in the region of Benjamin that the war begins between the house of Saul and the house of David. Do you remember World War? No, you won't remember because you weren't there, were you? But in your history, World War One. How World War One kicked off. It kicked off at a place, at a time, at a date, Sarajevo, 28th of June 1914, Archduke Franz Ferdinand was assassinated. That's when it all began. The war here between these two kingdoms of David and Saul, it begins here by this pool of Gibeon. How does it start? Well, Abner and his army move out of Mahanaim and go over to Gibeon. Now, what does that tell us? What does that tell us about Abner? Well, Mahanaim is over on the east side of the Jordan. Gibeon was on the west side, right over, in fact, on the border of Judah, where you remember David is now king. So, and with all these place names and people's names, we mustn't miss the point here. This is an act of aggression. What Abner is doing here is he is acting offensively in coming out of his hometown and coming to the very border of David's kingdom with his army and standing there, as it were, aggressively. The house of David then counters this act of aggression with Joab and David's men going out to meet them at Gibeon. What do we know about Joab? Well, Joab is one of those characters we will learn more and more about as we go through to Samuel. Chronologically, although up to this point here, we are told in 1 Chronicles 2, verses 15 and 16, that Joab is David's nephew. Uncle David, as it were, to Joab. Joab is one of three sons of David's sister, Zeruiah. You see them there in verse 18. Joab, Abishai, and Asahel. But these two armies meet at this pool of Gibeon, where they have this standoff. I say it's a standoff, but they're actually sat down. Joab and his guys are on one side, Abner and his men are on the other. And can you imagine in your mind, they're just sat there watching each other. They're just sat sussing each other out, sizing each other up as they gaze across this pool of water between them. We don't know how long it is that they just sit watching each other before Abner suggests a little sort of skirmish. I don't know whether he meant it as a sort of entertainment or whether he meant it like when David fought Goliath, 1 Samuel 17, where there Goliath was taunting the Israelites in verse 8, "Choose a man and have him come down to me. If he is able to fight and kill me, we will become your subjects. But if I overcome him and kill him, you will become our subjects and serve us." In other words, rather than have a full-scale battle, instead have a single champion come out from both sides, and whoever wins, that will determine the overall winner of the war. I remember back in 2002, just before the full-scale Iraq war kicked off, it was a bit of a joke, but an Iraqi vice president proposed that Saddam Hussein and George Bush do the same thing. That rather than have a full-scale invasion, Saddam Hussein and George Bush should go somewhere neutral and fight a duel to settle their differences. This person said that Kofi Annan should referee the duel. Of course, the White House just laughed it off. But that's maybe what Abner is doing here by the pool of Gibeon. Have 12 men from both sides come out and fight hand to hand in front of us. Let this small-scale contest determine the outcome of a full-scale battle. Even the very number of men chosen suggests it's a representative battle. 12 men for 12 tribes from both sides. Who will be the leader? Who will win? Who will govern Israel as a result of what happens here? So the 12 men are chosen. But they're all equally matched. And so you see in verse 16 that all 24 men kill each other and lie dead by the pool. That then kicks off verse 17, the very fierce battle between the two sides, with Abner's army losing heavily to David's. So we have all of this loss of life. We have all of this blood. Why? Because of Abner. He is the cause of it all. Possibly because of his ambition. Possibly because of his jealousy as well. If David will be king one day, which he knows he will be, but will Joab then be the general of Israel's army? You see, Abner, in a sense, wanted to be first. He wanted to be the one who would continue as commander of the army of Israel, as he had been under Saul. So in a sense here, Abner is like an Old Testament version of the New Testament Diotrephes, 3 John 9. He who loves to be first. Just as Diotrephes wouldn't accept John's authority as an apostle, so Abner here won't accept the fact that God has chosen David to be his king. And look at the trouble he's causing. He's rebellious. And so, like Diotrephes, he's causing trouble among God's people. Even just here by the pool of Gibeon, look at these 24 brethren of Israel now lying in a pool of blood. We wonder, had these young men ever fought side by side before? You see, they're all brethren of Israel. But look at them now, lay dead. And all because of this man, Abner. This man's rebellion, his ambition, his resistance to God's will. The second thing I want us to look at this evening is in verses 18 to 32, and it's the roadside pool of blood. Abner and whoever was left of his army, they now make a break for it because they're losing so heavily. But one of Joab's brothers, Asahel, he decides to chase after him. Now, it seems Asahel was a pretty fit guy. It's strange the way he's described in verse 18. Asahel was as fleet-footed as a wild gazelle. But he seems to be one of these sort of long-distance runners, but a speedy runner. He can maintain his stamina over some sort of long distance here. But instead of picking off the slower, the common sort of soldier, Asahel goes after the big fish. He goes after the top man. He wants the general himself. He wants Abner. And so you see him here relentlessly pursuing him. He's fast enough to catch up and to stick with him, but evidently he is not strong enough to fight him. And again, these are brethren. Do you see there how Abner knew him? Verse 20, Abner looked behind him and asked, "Is that you, Asahel?" You see, it's these little details we have in this narrative that reminds us of the tragedy in all of this. These are all brethren. These are our brothers. Abner knew Asahel. He knew Joab as well. You see that in verse 22. These were all members of the same covenant community of God's people. And yet, look at the cause and the effect of Abner's rebellion. Look at the amount of blood spilt from one person's sinful behavior. I just wonder, I wonder how much spiritual blood, so to speak, has been spilt in the church of Jesus Christ from people like Abner in it. Prominent figures, dominant figures, but men and women, but people with sinful motives, wrong motives, people wanting things done their way, people refusing to submit to leaders in the church or to the authority of Scripture, but insisting on doing things their way. And in the wake of their sinful goings on, there are casualties. Brethren fall. Congregations are damaged. Blood, as it were, is spilt. Abner recognizes Asahel. And so after warning Asahel twice to back off, Abner seemingly shoves the butt end of his spear so forcefully into Asahel's belly, it comes out the other side. What a picture. And we're told he dies. As Dale Ralph Davies puts it, Asahel had the speed, but Ahab had the spear. So there on the roadside lies Asahel's body in this pool of blood. And it is such a shock to the others, you see, there at the end of verse 23, that when they see Asahel's body, they stop the chase. They stop pursuing Abner and his army, and they just stop. It's as though it has dawned on them what's happening. Look what's going on between us here. Our brethren are dying. What are we doing? We're killing one another. It's tragic. It's such a sad ending to Asahel. Here was someone with such evident enthusiasm, with such evident determination, but you see again, don't you, cause and effect. Asahel wants a glory beyond his reach. Wouldn't it have been great for him to go home and say, I got the general. I went after him, I didn't stop, and I got him and I killed him. Would it have been wonderful for him to have gone home and told his family what he had done? He was so confident, so sure of his obvious giftedness in running, he wasn't aware of his apparent limitations in fighting. And in fighting someone like Abner. And so he fell. One old commentator writes, I say old because it's from centuries ago, Asahel fancied himself superior to an old man. A common and natural but grave fault in the young. He was slain as the penalty of self-confidence and rashness, besetting sins of many gifted youths. Matthew Henry comments, death often comes by ways we least suspect. We are often betrayed by the accomplishments we are proud of. Asahel's swiftness, which he presumed so much upon, did him no service, but hastened his end. We want to learn from this tonight, don't we? It's as the proverb tells us, Proverbs 16 and 18, pride goes before destruction, a haughty spirit before a fall. Particularly, yes, with young people. But when any of us think we're the strongest, when in our pride we are blinded into thinking we can take on more than we're ready for, because we do, in our sinful, natural tendency, we do tend to think more highly of ourselves than we ought to, as Paul tells us not to. But that's when we'll often fall. That's will often be the time when we'll get hurt, when we'll have to tend to some bruises. Sometimes God, in his mercy, he saves us, he stops us short of falling, but sometimes, like Simon Peter, do you remember his proud promises he made to Jesus? Sometimes we will fall. Sometimes God will humble us in our fall to then pick us up again, for us then to become hopefully a bit wiser, a bit more humble, a bit more aware of our limitations and abilities, really. So Asahel has fallen. The men are stopped in shock to see his body, but the pursuit continues now with Joab and Abishai chasing after Abner. And they continue until they come to a hill. They seem to have him cornered on the hill of Ammah in verse 24. Unsurprisingly, the men of Benjamin rally behind Abner. Benjamin was, of course, the tribe that Saul had come from. And so here they are, demonstrating their loyalty to Saul's general. But look, they're fighting a lost cause. They're surrounded. The odds are against them. And so in verse 26, Abner essentially calls on Joab to call off his men. Must the sword devour forever? Don't you realize that this will end in bitterness? How long before you order your men to stop pursuing who? Their brothers. Doesn't he make it sound as though he's the righteous one? And Joab is the bloodthirsty tyrant in all of this, pursuing him like that? But we mustn't forget it was Abner who started all of it back in verse 12. It was Abner who had suggested the 12 against 12 tournament by the pool of Gibeon. So now that he's losing, it's now that he appeals to Joab. How long before you order your men to stop pursuing their brothers? A few minutes ago it was their enemies, but now, oh yes, it's their brothers. And Joab knows that this plea for pity is just nonsense. He knows that if Abner hadn't proposed the tournament by the pool that morning, Joab's men wouldn't have pursued their brothers. But now it seems he listens. Now that Abner is clean on by his fingernails, Joab blows the trumpet. The chasing, the fighting ends. The armies return home under cover of darkness. I don't know if you're like me, but I mark my Bible. When there are words that come up repeatedly in a paragraph, I'll mark them. And you see there in that closing section of chapter 2, verse 29, and in verse 32, this matter of all night. All that night, Abner and his men marched through the Arabah. Verse 32, then Joab and his men marched all night and arrived at Hebron by daybreak. Now that may just be, well, it was nighttime, and so they were marching their way home. They were going home under the cover of darkness and so forth. But I just wonder that in the context of all of these brethren fighting, I wonder, is that darkness symbolic of shame? I wonder. Shame returning back to their camps. These brothers having fought each other. Even the detail there of burying Asahel. This good man, but now lost in the repercussions of these bad motives. Well, the third and final section to look at tonight is how the bloodline of David flows strong. And those, you see that in the opening five verses of chapter 3. Because what they show us there are just two things I want to mention, and then we're done. First of all, they're there to illustrate to us how David's house was growing stronger and stronger. Certainly over time, that this war now continues, having begun at the pool of Gibeon. Over time, more people, more surrounding villages to Judah may have joined themselves to David. But what we have in this list of wives and sons born to David at Hebron, they're given here to show us how David's house is strengthening. There's no mention anywhere of Ish-bosheth's family details. He seemingly has no bloodline to continue his kingship. But here, after reading in verse 1, that David grew stronger and stronger, you read of his first six sons. And therefore, David has plenty of potential succession to his throne of Judah. You get rid of David, another one pops up to take his place. Get rid of Ish-bosheth, who have you got? The second thing to show us, though, is that whilst David may have been God's chosen king, he certainly wasn't perfect. David wasn't Jesus. He's got six wives. In fact, if you include Michal, that's seven. It's a perfect number, but, you know, that's not good enough. 7 wives. In fact, you read here, he even married one woman for political reasons. Verse 3, Absalom, the son of Maacah, daughter of Talmai, king of Geshur. Geshur lay to the northeast of Ishbosheth's kingdom, so it's very likely David married Maacah not for love, but to strengthen his own kingdom. Look at how many wives David has. 6 wives, and that's just in Hebron. When he arrives in Jerusalem, he'll marry some more there. But it seems here that David has held more to the culture of that day, and for a king to have multiple wives, rather than what God had said in his word. Deuteronomy 17, verse 17. The king must not take many wives, or his heart will be led astray. And we know that from what Solomon, David's other son to come, what he will do in his lifetime, he has learned from his father. He takes many wives as well. Now, I know we could argue, well, how many is many? Whatever. But we are getting here just the beginnings of the picture that even though David is a great king for Israel, he's still a sinner. He is still prone to transgress God's law and to fall into sin. Even David here has wrong motives. And as we go through 2 Samuel, we'll discover the serious repercussions of those bad motives later on. David, though he was a type, he was not Jesus. So we've looked tonight at cause and effect, motives and repercussions. It's like a domino. It's like one of those trails you set up and you click the first domino and the next one falls and the next one falls and the next one falls. We need to learn from this passage tonight to check our motives. Why am I doing this? Why am I saying this? What will be, what might even be just the repercussions of what I do? And we need to learn here from Abner. Resistant, rebellious Abner. Abner who knew the truth and yet still refused or seemingly was unable to embrace the truth for himself. May God help us then to learn from this to be more evidently a holy, godly people to his praise and honor. Amen. Well, we close tonight.